Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We are at the point of the week where we do our interviews. And joining us, I have been trying to make this thing happen for the longest time because one of my favorite fun facts has always been that I graduated from the same high school as this gentleman across the table from me, from Gangstar DJ Premier.
Welcome, Premier, and shout to Mr. Bomani Jones.
Dude, I appreciate it, man. Like, this is what I told you the story a little earlier, but I think this one is always fun. So my brother is about your age, right, and he's always on the beats. Like, that was the thing he wanted to do. He wanted to get on the beats. And he had moved back to Houston, living with the parents, trying to get it going. And one of our friends, a professor, came in and said, now, what you don't want to do is you don't want to do like Ed Martin's son did, where he got all the way to the end on his degree in computer science and then just decided to go make music. And my brother was like, oh, okay. And then he went and found out who this was. He was like, no, this is exactly what I'm trying to do. Exactly what I'm trying to do DJ Premier.
All right. Then. Yeah, man. It kind of goes two ways. I didn't want to graduate and then not have something set in stone.
Right.
I wanted to be where if I don't make it, I still can come back to finish. I had something to look forward to.
Right.
So I, cause in Prairie View, just my coming up, the gossip was always, so and so just went away and they you know, but then they didn't make it and they're back working at the registrar's office.
Right.
And that's the type of stuff they would be saying about people instead of saying, well, you know, I'm glad that they're doing okay. It was always knocking them for coming back.
Right.
Well, for me, I wanted to come back successful, and because my father is a major success, I was influenced by him and my mom. Not was, I am influenced by both of them. And because of that, I just didn't want to have that same thing said about me if I did not make it. So I said, you know what? If I have I had 18 credits at the time, which now I remember right from my father passed, he said, well, since it's changed with the curriculums, you would have more than 18 credits to graduate but all the languages I learned, they don't do anymore.
Right.
Fortran and Basic, all that stuff's gone.
What's wild though is that if you still know Fortran, you can make $1 zillion because the government is still stuck on all those old programming languages.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's all the old stuff.
Wow.
Like there's a particular lane for you that if you know all that old stuff, because there's so many programs that are like, we're still there. Like what I've always wondered about, like in looking back at that time period, because I grew up right outside Houston. I went to school in Waller when I got there. But one thing about Houston, like even compared to a city like New Orleans, like New Orleans was a city that like hip hop hit and they were like, yo, this is what we do.
Right.
Houston wasn't really like a hip hop city in that way.
I graduated high school in 84 from Waller. At that time, Prince was huge and hip hop was still bubbling. You know, LL Cool J was hot, Run DMC, you know, Houdini, UTFO, stuff like that. So it was still just bubbling. But at that time, for me, it was all about the Rhinestone Wrangler, which was which is like in New York, the tunnel, but that was the tunnel. And Jay Prince was one of the owners. Mm-hmm. And I worked at the record store across the street on Merworth in South Main, which obviously Astro World's right across the street and the Astrodome is across the street. So at that time, hip hop was, that was the bubbling spot to go to the Rhinestone Wrangler on the weekends. It was really that jam packed. And the Ghetto Boys weren't even that big yet, but hip hop was just really booming.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the records were predominantly New York records. And I just was like, man, I gotta get there because all the jams that's rocking, that's got everybody wilding and dancing like crazy are New York records.
Right. And I wonder though, like when you tell people in the mid-80s, when you go tell them and you're like, yo, I'm about to go to New York and I'm going to make this rap thing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine how crazy that had to sound to people at that time.
My father was even like, dude, you have no plan. You know, that sounds like my father. And he's like, you have no plan. I'm like, daddy, I said, you know, cause I call him daddy. I'm like, daddy, listen, one of the reasons why I did want to go is cause my mom is from Baltimore, born and raised, and her father, moved to Brooklyn. Every summer whenever we had our summers, we'd leave Prairie View and go to Brooklyn and stay with him. And, you know, we'd stay in the city, but we'd always, it was because of my grandfather and his wife, Rooney, rest in peace to both of them. And being I was only boy and I have older sisters, I always was hung out with my grandfather because I love sports.
Right.
Yeah, well, actually, all of us, we all play sports. My sisters play sports. We're all sports heads. My mother knows sports very well. My father's actually the least sports oriented,
right,
but he's more about education. But all the rest of us know our sports very well. So with my grandfather being a big Yankee fan, I used to always go to the Yankee games with him, and then he would take me to Playland in Times Square to play pinball because I was into video games. Pinball was a big deal back in the right. early 80s, and I was an expert at it, so that's the reason why I always went to stay in New York. Even when my sisters became more teenagers, they were like, we don't want to keep going to New York every summer. We want to hang out with our friends in the summer. I kept going, and as it grew, I started to see the hip-hop develop in New York. I was there in 77 when the blackout happened. I witnessed so many things that are hip-hop-oriented way before I dreamed of making that my career, and that's what really built it. So once it got to the stage of me coming out of high school, going into Prairie View to go to college, I was like, man, this is definitely what I'm going to do, but let me see if I got a shot at it. And that's when I said, I'm leaving now because my heart, everything's with your gut.
Right.
My gut said it's time to go.
Exposure is a thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. I hear about that. Like, one thing I always realized, like, growing up, an advantage that I had over the kids I went to school with was what my parents did and where that could, like, the things that I could see. And so, right. like, I'm thinking about for you, the idea of, like, being in Brooklyn at all mm-hmm. at any of these times, let alone being there, like, the blackout is, like, a wild yeah. time for you to be here, and you're, like, 11 years old or something.
Exactly. That's something that was really fun to tell my friends. You know, every time we went back to school, they did the – everybody's going to say what they did for the summer. I'm like, yo, I saw a suicide. A man jumped in front of the subway, and we ran over him, which really happened. The day before, I'm going back to Texas for my summer. And it was me and my father on the train to go. My grandfather's waiting for us, and this guy just committed suicide, jumped in front of the train. We ran over him. We felt the train do the little jump like a speed bump. And then the guy says, there's been a suicide. We have to get off the train, but we got to move the train. So please, everybody, just please stand still. And when we reversed, we did the bump again.
Right.
And then when we got off, being that it was so just, it just happened. The police weren't there yet. We saw the body split, still on the tracks. The arm was separated and was moving, and, the fingers were moving. And we were like, for me, I'm like, oh, this is incredible. Where, for other people, like, this is ugly. And,
right.
But, or even New York is probably like, this is normal to us. But for me, this is like, this is where I want to be. I see people stealing the bicycle tires. And just right off the pole and just leave the bike and take the wheels. I was like, man, this is an amazing place. This is where I want
to
be.
How long did it take you to catch the rhythm of the place though, right? Cause this is a whole different world than where you were.
Honestly, pretty fast because my dad knows I was very fast out in the street. Like he knows that. My mom knows that. They were hearing rumors about me doing up to no good. I never got caught, mm-hmm. but. Even in high school when I was at Waller, the snack bar, we had the cafeteria where you get to, use the meal ticket mm-hmm. and then you had the snack bar. That's having the pizzas and all that. And you could write a check. I was writing checks for $6 and stuff, which was a big deal back then to get pizza and stuff. And one of the ladies who I thought was a friend of mine because we were really cool was telling everybody that I was dealing drugs and all that. And I was like, why you always smile on my face? But you're telling my mom who's the art teacher at Waller. Right. So she's like, yeah, they're saying this about you. And I'm like, those rumors were going around. And again, I always moved swiftly because I didn't want to disappoint my parents. I didn't want them to find out I'm being arrested or anything like that. So I always made sure that I moved accordingly to never get caught in any wrongdoing so that I wouldn't disappoint them. They were still on my mind even when I was doing my dirt.
Right.
So when I moved, I knew that I had to really, really be, or at least pretend to be advanced so that even New Yorkers wouldn't think that they could get the best of me. Cause I know that that's how they look at us if we're not from New York.
Right.
So all of that was on my mind. My grandfather was like, you're not built for this and all that. I'm like, yeah, I am. You really haven't seen me move around.
I
had fun in my high school years. I was an office aide, so I knew when the dope dog was coming, mm-hmm. All that stuff. So, I played football a couple of years and I just believed it was time. And then, in Texas, at least for us, my dad taught me how to drive when I was 11, because if you don't have license back, at those
age. Oh, yeah, it's back roads, man.
But even that, the police know whose kid is whose.
Right.
They're not going to stop you, at least not back in that era. And they see, and usually your parents send you to the store to get the groceries and do everything and run the errands without a license. And it's no big deal. I was just telling one of my boys where we're from, you don't have to wear a helmet to ride a motorcycle still.
Right.
You can ride without a helmet here. you know, seeing kids with helmets on bicycles. I'm like, man, we never did any of that. You're banging nuts on that bar and you learn what it's like to fall and hurt yourself and you know not to do it again, right. You know, so that's always been my mentality and I still live with that to this day.
And Brooklyn's where you met Guru.
Yeah. Going back to Brooklyn right before I got my career off the ground, a shout to Gordon and Gary Franklin. They went to Prairie View. And to see anybody from New York at Prairie View in 84, 85 was like a big deal. Like, yo, you from New York?
Right.
You know, where you from? Oh, from Brooklyn. Oh, you from Brooklyn? Because it was always, if you're from Brooklyn, it was like you were the flyest if you're from Brooklyn or the Bronx. We got cool. They were part of me getting my music demos together and all the parties I used to do for all the frats and the sororities. And then from there, I moved in with their parents. And then they were like, his father, they were West Indian family, all from Trinidad. His father was really harsh. He was like, I know y'all doing drugs down in the basement. We're like, no, we're not. What's that smell? What's that smell? I know what that smell is. You think I don't know that smell? And why are you going when you sneeze? I'm like, we're not doing anything. You know, you could literally do this.
Right.
And rub your nose. And he's like, oh, why are you rubbing your nose? It's like, Mr. Franklin, I mean, I'm rubbing my nose. It itches. Yeah, I know what that itching is. Like, you know, that type of stuff. And he was like, look, you could live here, but you have to get a job. If you don't have a job, you have to at least be out of my house until I get home from work. And once I get home from work, you can come back in the house and be like, damn, where are we going to go? So I ended up getting a job. Me and my MC Top, who was my MC I met in Prairie View, is from Boston. That's how we ended up putting our group together. So we got a job at Young People's Day Camp. And we became counselors with no experience, but they had a shortage of staff. And they were like, you know, y'all think y'all good with kids? And we already knew we were going to be good with kids because we were into rap.
Right.
And they loved us. They wanted to bring us back the next year. But my MC ended up going into the military. I had already met Guru, and he wanted me to be in the group. But I was like, I'm not going to abandon the guys I came with. So I was like, I can't do it. I got to stick with my guys. Once he joined the military, I remember it was a Saturday. And he told me he was going to enlist, but I thought he was just, you know, talking nonsense. Next thing you know, the recruiting officer rings the bell, and they're like, yeah, we came to get Theodore Campbell today. And I'm like, for what? And he goes, he enlisted, and today is the day. And I remember looking down at the basement going, yo, Top. And as he's coming up the stairs, I'm thinking he's going to be like, yo, what's up? You know, he's already packed with his duffel bag.
Oh, wow.
So he knew he was leaving. He didn't tell me. And I'm like, what am I going to do now without you? Like, this is my MC. He's like, dude, I'm going to Navy. I said, well, how long? If he had enlisted for a year, I was definitely going to wait. He said 4 years. I'm like, then, dude, I'm gone. Called Guru back and Stu Fine, who owned Wild Pitch Records, the label. And I said, yo, my guy left. I'm all alone now. He said, well, good. I want you in the group still. I said, cool. So how do we divvy up the money? He said, well, hold on. You can't divvy up the money if you're just going to be my DJ. You ain't going to get paid that much. I said, well, what do I need to do to get 50%? He said, you have to produce the album because you don't write rhymes. And that's my 50%. I said, all right, I'm going to perfect producing. I wasn't that good then. When we did our first album, it was me, my engineer, Slomo, and Guru. We would all line up next to the drum machine and tap the buttons together. That's why if you listen to the first album, there's more of an amateur sound to it. Then after that album came out and it did well, then I started just practicing every day with one of my mentors, King of Chill, who produced MC Lights, Paper Thin, Cha Cha Cha, Stop Looking Listen. He was part of Top Billing with the Audio 2 and all that stuff. And we became friends because they went to high school with Gordon and Gary, who went to Prairie View. So that's how we linked. And then from there, I perfected my craft. And the Step in the Arena came out, and now I was more confident to say I could really do this, and then the name started to spread.
It's interesting to think that you did not have an eye toward producing until then, though, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of, like, for me, that's wild to think about, because your production is so precise
right.
that it's hard to think that this wasn't, like, a grand vision that it started way sooner.
I just wanted to be the DJ, you know, because I see Jam Master Jay, I see Terminator X, I see Action with how, you know, Poke from Tone and Poke, the track masters. Poke was just a DJ for Chubb Rock. And I'm seeing all these guys DJing, so I want to be. I knew I got nice on the wheels thanks to my guy R.P. Cola, who's was the DJ at the Rhinestone Wrangling. He was on Magic 102.
I was about to say that. That name jumped out to me. Magic
102. Yeah, Magic 102. That's when they played. Well, everybody's playing hip hop then and had a mix show. And then he would teach me in his dorm how to work the faders. I knew how to blend, but I didn't know how to cut and scratch and all of that. And then once I learned that, I graduated to the stage of producing.
Now, also imagine, like, when you met Guru, like, he had gone to Morehouse and graduated by then, but y'all mm-hmm. in kind of similar positions where at some point you had to call your professional parents and be like, nah, man, we about to make this rappity rap, dog.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for my, once the album came out, because I went home for Thanksgiving, Stu Fine said, hey, we're going to do a video to Words Are Manifest. And so I had to fly back to shoot the video. And then I went back to Prairie View to go to school again. And then he said, hey, man, the record's taking off. We need to do an album. So I left school again, flew back to do the album. We did it in about 12 days, the album. No More Mr. Nice Guy. And from there, I was like, you know what? I'm going to put school on hold and just do this, because now we were getting shows and now we're traveling. And then from there, it just got better and better. We, Spike Lee saw our video for Words Are Manifest. He thought that Guru looked very much like Malcolm X in the video. He bought the album. When he bought the album, he heard a song called Jazz Music, which was a tribute to my grandfather who played jazz and his grandfather who played jazz. When he heard that, it happened to be around the same time he was shooting the Mo' Better Blues movie with Denzel Washington and Wesley Snipes. When he asked us to do a more updated version, he said we left out a lot of names that weren't mentioned in our version. He gave us this list from a guy named Eric Eli. It was a poem that didn't rhyme. What is it? I don't know what you call it when a poem doesn't rhyme, but it's still a poem. Guru took that.
So you want me to just take these names and just do it my way? He said, yeah.
And that's how he did. He looked at the list to put it into a flow. We did that for Mo' Better Blues. I remember they gave us a check for like $50,000. We were like, yo, we're rich, which we weren't. But for us, that was our first check. We were really struggling living in a studio apartment with me, my dancer, who went to Prairie View as well. He was in the PV marching band. And his name is Wendell Thompson, but we call him HL Rock. This is when Terry Ellis from En Vogue.
Yeah, she was one of the Black Foxes
at
TV.
And she used to sing during the halftime. And right when she would sing, Wendell would do I'm Bad by LL. So he got really popular at school for that. And he came with me and rode with me in my truck. We drove together, pouring rain with no cover on my truck. And all my records got ruined. Everything, my entire life of my records got totally water damaged. Man. Like, man, my life's over. But I prevailed, and some of them were salvaged, and some of them were Question Remains, which it has a lot of dirt on it. All that in Question Remains is from the Water Damage records, but that became one of our hits, too. So some things happened for a reason.
You know, and all of this really makes sense, because the third album for you guys is the one that for most people is like, okay, now they're like here. Like, Step Into the Arena was dope.
But
Daily Operation is the one where it's like, yo, like, did you catch up on that one? And I guess you talk about the progression for you, that, you know, learning what you were doing basically at that point, that it would make sense that that would be the point where it just all kind of came together. Like, was that how it felt for you at that time?
Yeah, because by that time, that's when I was really confident I am a producer. Step in the Arena, I was still getting better, but Daily Operation, that's when KRS-One called me and said, I'm doing this project called Return of the Boom Bap. I really want you to be a part of it in a major way. So that's when it all started to really come together, where I felt confident that anybody that approached me to be produced, I could do it.
Now, how much, like, beside DJing, how much musical experience and training did you have up until this point before becoming a producer?
I took piano lessons, you know, like any kid when you're, but then I want to go out and play Cowboys and Indians and all that crazy stuff and Red Light, Green Light and Batman and Robin and, you know, the Cowboys, you know, like I said, Cowboys and Indians and stuff like that, Cap Guns. And when you get to that point, especially growing up in a country town like Prairie View where there's no big city, that upbringing set the whole just framework of what made me be what I am as well, because I carry that with me. So piano lessons got to a point where I mastered it. But then I was like, Mom, I don't want to do this anymore. I was an altar boy in Catholic Church. And I don't know if you remember the Newman Center.
Right? Oh, yeah.
See, I went to St. Martin de Porres Church, and Newman Center was our place to really get down. So all of that stuff was more what I was geared towards. Where I was like, Mom, I don't want to do piano lessons. And every time Donnie and Deb, my sisters, get to not go to church or go do things. You let them not do it, but you make me do it. She said, yeah, cause you need God in your life and it keeps you out of trouble. So I was like, all right. And then but she finally let me quit. Then by the time I got around to junior high, maybe seventh or eighth, maybe even ninth grade, Travis Scott's dad, who lived across the street from us and his grandmother, Ms. Webster, Bernice Webster, is my English teacher. So Travis Scott's real name is Jack Webster III. His dad's name is Jacques, really, Jacques mm-hmm. Webster, but his dad is Jacques. No, he's not Jack Webster. No, Travis Scott is, cause his dad called him Junior.
Mm-hmm.
Cause one day I was talking to him, saying, hey man, I want to go catch, your son in Miami for New Year. And he goes, he calls him up and goes, yo, Junior, make sure you look out for Chris Junior. You know, and he's like, I got him, dad. But that's how he said it. So, but way before Travis Scott was even born, his father and his brother Travis, were my mentors in learning how to play bass and drums. That became my all-time focus when I started doing production. A lot of people to this day say, man, your drums. And even my bass player in my band, the Batter Band, his name is Brady Watt. He's like, man, what bass were you playing on Mass Appeal? And what bass were you playing on this song? I'm like, dude, that's keyboard. He goes, but it sounds like a bass. I'm like, yeah, because I'm playing it like a bass player mentality. And all that comes from Travis and Jack. So.
Yeah. Precision is always the thing I think about with the drums, because it's not like it's this adventurous range of drum sounds, right? It's like, right. You can give me four drum sounds and I can make this go. Like, that's always the impression that I got from, like, what the mentality was
on it. They're a major part of teaching me how to master that. And so I always give praise to Jack and Travis. And Travis Scott changed his name to Travis Scott because he that's his favorite uncle.
Mm-hmm.
Travis was the life of the party when we were kids coming to, you know, cause my older sisters, you know, we do a lot of house parties or in the neighborhood. And Travis, when I was young, I was like, is Travis coming? Like, that's how much we were really into them showing up, because he always made the party great. And he's always very funny. His mother's very funny. Ms. Webster will have you laughing so hard. She's the first one to call us when we was kids, and for us to be young kids, she'd always be like, and I say, Miss Webster, why you call us when we were kids? She goes, it's in the dictionary. Hey.
Oh, okay.
Can't fight that.
Yeah, no, especially a kid. Like, I really don't have a retort, ma'am.
But to be, you know, like 10, 11 years old and have her talk to us like that when we were kids, we used to just love to hear her curse. And she's so real. You know, shout out to Bernice Webster. She is the greatest. And shout out to Jack and Travis's sister, Sonora. We call her Vivi. So those are the three kids from Ms. Webster. And shout out to Wayman, who's their father. My father played cards with them every Wednesday and Thursday. They played bridge. And even when Mr. Webster passed, my father said, let's cancel the game. And Ms. Webster's like, no, he would want y'all to play. I'll fill in for him, but we're playing tonight. Mm-hmm. Just even before they buried him, you know. So that's how much it's a serious thing when they play cards.
Yeah, man. I was thinking, like, also with the beats. Like, I always, once I realized that you had the computer, in a lot of ways, like, I thought about the simplicity, because one thing about doing computer programming, I realized after I took a couple of classes, mm-hmm. a lot of it is getting rid of the noise, right? Like every keystroke is room for a mistake. And so you're just trying to keep everything that needs to be there.
Right.
And your scratches, I thought of them as like calls to like other programs, right?
Wow.
Like you scratch the record and it's like, we're taking something from this other song that we already knew and then we're bringing it into this one, right? So I was always curious about the actual musical training, because I could hear that technical side mm-hmm. of it also when I would listen.
Yeah, just studying all the great artists, like I said, from Run DMC to LL Cool J, and seeing how their DJs would do little scratch lines and hooks, and especially once Public Enemy came out, because they were using so many things to tie their songs in. And it's like, oh man, you took that from songs. Oh man, that's from this. Oh, that's from that, and that's from this. And you were just so amazed that they pinpointed the same things that we either played at our jams or just were familiar with from just all the records. And then again, with me being 53 now, we grew up before rap, so there was no rap records to really be raised on in my childhood, and it was more my teenage years that started to become a thing. So for us, it was either Curtis Mayfield, Barry White, all the stuff my mom played, you know, Jimi Hendrix, you know, Minnie Riperton, Natalie Cole, Ozzy Brothers, Graham Central Station, the Brothers Johnson, you know, just all that stuff, man. That's Al Green, that, and anything Motown, that was our schooling. That's the reason why it's like, I pay homage to the ones that came before me for life. The youngsters need to always take a page out of that book if they want to have a career that has a longevity stamp on it. And I got into it for the long haul from off rip.
Now, as a producer, did it take you a while to realize that there was more than just making beats to being a producer? Because I think for a lot of people, it's like, cool, I'm able to beat together, but that's not the same thing as like putting together a
right,
record.
Right, yeah. I feel like there's beat makers and there's producers. Producers are like coaches. You know, we may not be playing on the field, and you have your quarterback and, you know, your linemen and your backs and everything, but, and your kickers, but the coach still has to make the team. You know, I'm like a Belichick. You know, I'm going to make sure that I assemble the team to be right. But the only difference is for me, I do all the music and production myself, where you have people that may do the drums and have people help them, even though they call themselves the producer, which they can. Like, you know, Dre will have somebody maybe programming the beat. He'll do it as well. But at the same time, for me, a producer will coach the vocals. I might say, hey, go back to that line right there. Your voice squeaked right there and play it back. Sometimes they'll even go, no, it didn't. It's like, yeah, it did, because you're rapping it. I'm sitting in the other control room listening to you spit. Or
you might sound like you're tired. Your energy's low. Pick it up a little bit. Or you're a little too hyped. Come down a little and spit it the same way.
Those types of things is based off of feel. I know that Aretha Franklin said that she's based off of feel. A lot of artists that Bootsy, James Brown, they said a lot of things were based off of feel and not just the accuracy of uniform way of how it's supposed to go down. Right. You know, there's really no rules on how you do music. It just has to feel like it's ready, and that's where I come in.
Right, and you're a bit of a legendary perfectionist, right?
Oh, yeah. Very much so. I mean,
well, hold on. Who's more of a perfectionist, though, you or Dre?
Oh, Dre.
I guess because we hear your music, right?
Well, when we did the Compton soundtrack,
yeah. He said, yo, let's do a shout out together at the end. And now I know how I like to project my voice. And he goes, let's say this is Dr. Dre and DJ Premier. And I said, yeah, this is DJ Premier. He goes, nah, again. I go, but that's the way I said it. He goes, nah, again.
I says, DJ Premier. He goes, nah, again. I'm like, dude, that's the way I said it. Again. DJ Premier. He goes, nah, again. More. And I'm like, no, man. But he made me do it at least 23 times.
Dude, I have to say, that track on so many levels for me, right? Because they didn't really do a lot of promo for the Compton soundtrack, right? So I think for a lot of people, it's kind of forgotten. But
yeah, he decided last minute.
Yeah.
He was working on another project that he wanted me on, and we were working on that. Mm-hmm. Out of nowhere, once the movie was finally edited, he saw the movie finally edited, and just out of nowhere goes, yo, all that stuff that you sent me to work on this other project, forget it. We're now going to go, I'm going to do a soundtrack to the movie. So it was a last minute decision. So. Yeah,
and then you took Animals, which is my favorite joint off of there.
Oh, thank you.
And that whole album, like, that was my full on Welcome to Anderson .Paak moment. And he is my, like, literally my, like, my favorite
Paak
at this point.
Oh, he's so dope.
And so then I realized that this is like the Voltron of my teenage years. Cause right. Like at that time, the idea of West Coast Dr. Dre and your East Coast sound, like we would never think that they were coming together. And then I get it on the record and then I'm listening to it and I'm like, oh man, I can kind of, this is a Dre element that's in here, right? Like those synths that, and that cliff that comes after, I'm like, okay, that's a Primo thing, right? Like, and that was just like, it blew my mind. And then it made sense to me that Dre heard the track and was like, okay, need this on the album, buddy.
Well, that's really what happened.
Me and Anderson .Paak were in Russia, in Moscow, to do this thing for Boiler Room. And, it was to where I don't collaborate with other producers, so it was the first time to have me collaborate with a Russian producer. It was the payment was lucrative, and then I was like, you know, why not? And the kid was like the most popular producer out there. Shout to BMB Space Kid. So MF Doom was supposed to come with me, and he got sick and had to have emergency surgery. When they told us that, I'm like, so is the trip canceled? They were like, nah, they want you to still come, but do you mind if it's a singer instead of a rapper? And I'm like, well, who's the singer? They said Anderson .Paak. I'm like, who the hell is that? They were like, we can send you a couple links of his videos if you want to see that just to get a reference. And I'm like, Anderson .Paak? You know, even that, I was like, all right, send me the links. And they sent me three links, and there was one called Suede. And when I saw it, the gear he had, the bow tie, the black checkerboard, but he had a green bow tie, and he's just smiling like he knows that he's got this down. And then I see Knowledge, who I knew from Stone's Throw, in the video with him doing the beat. I'm like, damn, that's Knowledge. So already I'm like, okay, I know somebody affiliated.
So and the video's dope. It's called Suede.
And off that one video, I was like, yo, I'm in. I like this guy's voice. He looks like he enjoys recording music. And I started doing my homework on him. He met us in Moscow, and we did two records. The first record, it was called Till It's Done. It was more of a bounce record, not my style, but I said, you know, it's for this project. Why not? Then we did the Animals beat, but we didn't get to finish it or record it. So he said, man, I'll take it with me, and maybe we'll mess with it. Because B&B, the Russian producer, said, I want to do the bounce record and keep that as the one we release. The Animals beat. We get back to the States, and then when Freddie Gray got killed by the police, Anderson .Paak calls me and goes, yo, man, I'm so angry. What's going on with Freddie Gray? He said, I want to do a joint saying, to pop about the police. And I was like, what's it going to be called? He said, it's going to be called FSU up. And I was like, all right, cool. Let's do it. And he said, we'll just throw it out. And I was like, bet. The day we were, at least that week when we planned to throw it out, he said, yeah, I got a meeting with Dr. Dre. I'm going to go meet up with him. He wants me to be on some songs. He heard some stuff I did and X, Y, Z. I was like, okay, cool. Hope you're going to start getting some work in. Boom. He calls me maybe 3 or 4 days after he told me that. And he calls me and goes, hey, man, I'm here with Dre. I told him we just got back from Moscow. And I told him about the Freddie Gray thing. And he wants to hear that record we did, but it wasn't finished. And I was like, you know what? You can let him hear it. You can let him hear it. Yeah, Dre's a producer. He'll get it, even though it's still rough.
Soon as he listened to it, because he didn't want to play it for Dre without my permission,
right,
which I appreciate. Thank you, Pac. And I said, yeah, to play it for Dre.
2 minutes later, Dre calls and he said, Dre wants to talk to you. Dre was like, yo, man, I need you out here now. I want that record. I'm like, well, we were getting ready to release. He said, no, I need this. And I was like, well, what do you want to do something to it? He said, I want to add a couple things to it, but it's really good as it is.
So I was like, okay. And I flew out there maybe like a day or two later.
And I stayed out there for like 2 weeks, and we worked. He showed me the movie. You know, of course, you know, he has a movie theater,
right,
and we watched the movie. And then, we went to, he bought Tom Brady's house. So he was building that, but he had another house in Malibu. So we would work in his, but then he took Michael Jackson's studio, decked it out with all the, I can handle the loudest sound in the world. Trust me. Everybody will tell you, how do you play stuff so loud? And I'm not even one of those guys that'll go, huh, what'd you say? Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm losing my hearing. It's so loud. I was doing this, covering my ears like, yo, this is loud. He has so many speakers. And there's these speakers called the NS10s by Yamaha that are very rare to find and to replace the speakers. He was blowing them like every maybe half hour. And as soon as they would blow, a guy would, it seemed like he would push a button, a guy would raise up, take the speaker, raise back up and put another one up. And I'm like, where are you getting all these?
Like, that's how many.
He's got a warehouse, a basement full of speakers.
He probably does. I was like, yeah, because they're like $110 a piece to just replace them. And again, they're rare to find unless you know the people to go to. It happened every time. Dude would squat down, raise it up, squat back down, and there's a new one. And I'm just like, damn, Dre's rich, you know? So, yeah, but, that we used to, when we went to his house, that's when he added the other elements. And what I liked about Dre is there were certain things I was like, can we not put that there and remove that? And he's like, yeah, I like it. And I was like, I don't like it there because it's too much going on there. Why don't we do it on the last two bars? Take those bars out. And he was like,
play that back?
Yeah. Do it Preem's way. And that was so dope because I've heard the story. Like, you're not getting past Dre. He's the final say, and that's that. He was totally cool.
How much of an adjustment was it for you to be sharing the beat like that? Because you said you normally do it all by yourself.
Yeah. I was excited just to work with him anyway. And then Dre and I have known each other for many years and have been in studio sessions, but not where I'm working. I'm just hanging out and watching him do what he does. So I was, like I said, slightly worried in the beginning because I know how much he is in control, and then I know how selfish I am to have it my way as well. So I was like, I hope we don't bump heads, but we didn't. You know, my disagreements, he totally respected, and just the professionalism of when the credits were done, they were like, we were going to start running the artwork. We just want to make sure every spelling is right. Can you please check it today to make sure every spelling is right? We don't want anything misspelled. Just all that stuff where I just see my, you know, Premiere with an E on the end, which I hate. I'm like, it's not an E on the end. People spell Primo, P-R-I-M-O, P-R-E-M-O. The reason why I spell it P-R-E-E-M-O is because when Guru used to write me notes to tell me something to either do in the studio if he couldn't make it, yo, Primo, can you do this for me or run me a copy of this so I can finish writing? And since he spelled it that way, I said, well, that's the way I'm going to spell it. You know, but Dre was great, man. We had fun mixing it together. And, you know, I remember my manager, Ian, I was like, yo, now listen, when we go there, do not ask for a picture the day we get there. You know, when we're wrapping up, then ask for your picture because I don't want it to look like we're ready to get on the gram and post a picture. I remember his crew, like a lot of his team was like, oh man, Dream's here. Yo, we gotta get a picture. And Dre was like, nah, let me do it on my phone first. I was like, damn, Dre's saying, let's take a picture. I'm like, well, I'm doing mine now then too. And, that's the picture that ended up going all over the world with us sitting on the stools. That was his picture. So from there, if Dre's is excited to post his, I'm posting mine. I said, I'm just not gonna say what we're doing.
Right.
It just said working.
Right.
And everybody went crazy, like, what is it? That's how it happened.
One thing I wanted to ask about, like, your sound, and I think it's kind of the same with Dre, is that as time has gone, your sound has changed a little. It feels like there's more elements in the sound now,
right.
I guess it's as the equipment changes and everything else. For you, is that just kind of a gradual progression when that happens, or like a conscious effort, like, I want to take this to a different place?
I think it's both, because our new Gangster album that just came out is back to all different styles from the 90s era. There's a song called Bless the Mic, which is actually the first song I recorded for the new album. And, it reminds me of the Step in the Arena 1990 era, not even 90s, just actually 1990. And it was the first one I did to get into the groove of doing the album, being that he passed and I did make the music match his vocals. And then you have ones like Bad Name that sounds like the more traditional late 2000s style I do. And then you have a record like So Many Rappers that's very intricate with all these different arrangements that I've never done on a track. So the thing I like is I now use an MPC. I've been using an MPC, Akai MPC 60 drum machine since 1992. I now use the software version, which I'm not really into computer generated drum machines, but it's still an MPC. It's called the Renaissance. Software is on the screen. The drum machine still has the same pads and the face is the same, so I'm used to the look and the adjustments of things. It's just some additional stuff you got to do on the computer, but it's still the same application. The only difference is now I have more sample time. We're used to the SP-1200 and this sampler called the Akai 950, where you only have 60 seconds. In that 60 seconds, that's drums, samples, every other thing, and it's very limited. So I still program, like, if I'm limited to 60 seconds, even though now I can sample 5 hours and still have memory left over. But when I started to work on Prime with Royce da 5'9", the project was to take somebody else's sound and manipulate it into a Premiere-style beat. Adrian Young was the first one that I had to do it with. Being his instrumentation so vast, I was like, man, this is dope. I don't have to put it into 60 seconds sample space time, but I'm going to apply it like if I only have 60 seconds. And that's where the broadness started to expand. So I'd say around 2003, I started to change up the style and extend it more.
Hank Shockley made this point, and it really like kind of changed the way I looked at how new stuff sounds, which was just
my fault. I said 2003, 2014.
Got you. The thing about doing stuff on tape versus digital is the physical slapping of the tape, right? And it's like the hardest thing to reproduce in modern sounds is all the compression from the sample that you had there and the actual indentation on the tape. You know, so like snares from the 90s snap in a way that it's hard to make them do in this day and age. Is that one of the challenges for you in like coming up with what you want things to sound like now?
Not really, because of, like you said, we know from the tape experience, which is all we had to go by, you know, doing everything on 2-inch tape, that now with all these compressions and people putting 10 plugins on a track, and it's like, you don't need all of that. Stick with the basics, but everybody's like, man, I got the new such and such. And thing is, the more plugins you add affects, and the order if you put it in. If I put a a compressor on top and then an equalizer and then another, you know, thing to enhance the vocal. If I put it 1, 2, 3 and instead of 3, 2, 1 or 3, 1, 2, it'll change everything. Me, everything is still by, I'm more by ear. Even though I know how to play instruments, everything's still by ear. So that's my approach.
All right, we'll be back in a minute with more from DJ Premier, but first, hiring can be a slow process. Cafe El Toro COO Dylan Miskowitz needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants, so he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones, and that's how Dylan found his director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BOMANI. ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter, smartest way to hire. Now, I want to talk to you about the new Gangsta record. It's one of the best yet is the title, yes. Right? And Guru passed away in 2010. Mm-hmm. Fun fact, first person I ever interviewed.
Wow, I didn't know y'all did
right.
an interview.
All right. Also, the first person ever to stand me up for an interview. I sat in the lobby.
Didn't know that
yeah,
either.
I sat in the lobby at the Ritz-Carlton because I was interviewing him for the school paper, and he didn't make it down, and then I talked to him the next day.
Right.
And it was interesting because I'm this young whippersnapper.
Right.
And it's 2000. It's the year 2000.
Never knew that.
And I remember I asked him inadvertently. I was like, all right, cool. You went to Morehouse. I was like, so what year did you graduate? And he thought I was trying to play him. Mm. Right. And I was like, oh no, my bad. I was just trying to get my details correct.
That's cool. That's cool.
But my story, and I just remember he was talking about, he was like, yo, I want to make sure these young cats know that I still got it. Right. This is where he was going. I think this is like around Jazzmatazz 2.
Right.
Like the one with the Macy Gray track and all of that stuff. You know, like the idea of a DJ and an MC is kind of antiquated to people now, but I think of all the DJ, MC pairings, you guys are probably like right up there in terms of like people think about it in that way, that you are like standard bearers for that form. What was it for you like going back? He's been gone for 9 years and these vocals seem to go back to all these different time periods. Mm-hmm. What was the process like for you in getting together and deciding what you wanted to do with it?
Very emotional. I'm not a crier at all. I'm very stoic like my pops and you know, we just don't show emotions. I cried a lot, man, but I by myself was just like, damn, man, you should be here. And, you know, he died tragically and it was just an ugly ending. And, his family gave me some of his ashes. So I brought the ashes to every session. I'd bless it with sage, which is known to ward off evil energy. And I actually created my own little witchcraft ritual that I would do before I'd start working on the music. And I twirled the smoke around till it bellowed around the bag of his incense. I took the incense out of the urn and just did this little ritual that I do every day when it's Gangstar related. I don't do it every day for other stuff I work on, but if it's Gangstar related, it's a must. I do that. And then that would get me into the vibe of doing the tracks. And then from there, I'm so used to him writing to my tracks on the spot and I make the tracks on the spot. Now I had to make the tracks and write to him. And that was different, but I know how we work together. So now it was just about, I bought like 30 tracks, from his former partner. And I just said, let me just, listen to the ones that sound like they're more album ready. And then I just started to think, okay, well, this one only has one verse and no hook. And this one has two hooks, but no verse. And I just started just mixing them together based off tempo, started making phone calls to everybody and everybody, you know, came to the table. As soon as I said it's even that, I'm like, they're like a Gangstar album. Oh yeah, I'm in. They weren't like, and they're like, well, how do you, what is it from old vocals that y'all released? I'm like, nah, this is stuff even I never heard. They're like, oh yeah, I'm in. They thought I was going to be like, I said, there's no diss to Biggie, but I didn't like the Duets album because it was the same Juicy lyrics and, you know, One More Chance lyrics and just put to a different beats with big high profile guests. I want rhymes I haven't heard before, you know, and that's what the world is getting. So that was the approach. It came out very, very tip top to my satisfaction. I know when an album's ready to go, And we pulled the trigger.
As the perfectionist, it had to be kind of interesting to work with vocal tracks where this was the vocal track you had.
Yeah.
Like there was no change in what it was going
to be. Right. And then, like I said, it was emotional because I know how proud he is of this album spiritually. And then on top of that, I'm thinking about his family. His son was 9 when he passed. Now he's 19. And, you know, he had a lot of questions about his dad in the past. And then we've been documenting our career since 89. I was always into filming. Thank goodness I saved all these tapes. I've been showing them everything. And even with the video that we dropped back in September with J. Cole, the footage that I've been sitting on all these years even has him when his son was a baby and shows that. You know, so I'm glad that we saved all this stuff because I told him, dude, everything is yours. Just let me make your copy. I got to keep the master version, but you get a copy of whatever you want. You want to know the bad side of your dad, I'm going to tell you, and not sugarcoat it, because your dad had a lot of issues that we didn't like. But I'm also tell you the good side, and you're going to see it in this footage. Yeah, we got everything. Fights, have fun, everything.
Now, a mutual friend of ours, Stereo Williams, put this together, you know, to get the interview going. He told me, he was like, "Well, Primo, say you hard on his man, Guru."
on Twitter, right?
Yeah. And you know what's interesting about it is that I have been hard on Guru at points, right? And it's actually not really as much a problem with Guru is that there's the wing of backpack hip hoppers who often discredit a lot of the stuff that I grew up on and that I love. And then this becomes like a flag bearer. But I also realized when I went back and listened, like I always dug Q-Tip, but I have a much different appreciation for Q-Tip at this point. Cause what I didn't appreciate at the time is like the value of like feel, right? Of just like the vibe and just like how you ride a beat, and not every single lyric has to be like something that just like hits you over the head. And when I've listened to the Gangstar stuff recently, that's what got me in going back, was just like, yo, so this is like the king of monotone stuff. You say that or whatever, but there was a value to the monotone that I didn't like fully appreciate at the time. And like for you, when you were making music with him, what was the thing about his voice and as an MC that you thought as a producer is like, yo, this is the best thing that I can bring out?
Yeah. Well, that was it.
It was like, I used to tell him, I said, man, your voice is so different and your accent is so different. You have to have the right music to make your voice glow. I said, so you need, you know, that's why I started doing the jazz samples to bring him out more, but I still gave him big drums. And then that he seemed to just blend better with that. His previous music, I was just like, man, you got to have the music match your tone. And that's where Mass Appeal and, you know, Code of the Streets and even Step in the Arena and songs like that, just to get a rep, they just matched tone-wise with the way my tracks are. And a lot of those were jazz-oriented samples. Later on, obviously, we took it to funk and other things, but that was my approach just by ear. And my ear was saying, this is where you need to fit better, to make you sound better than other MCs we look up to, you know, from the Kool G Raps and Big Daddy Kane. And cause they were more hardcore. And I was like, you could sound hardcore, just stay monotone. When Take It Personal is hard, you know, and even just the way he sounds on Take It Personal, it sounds like you got a hoodie on ready to, you know, chase somebody and you're running after them just to smack them upside their head and they don't want to get smacked. That's where I come in to tailor. He called me a beat tailor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I do. I tailor the beats. And yeah, back when that happened, everybody's, you know, I remember I was with one of my boys and they were like, damn, man, hey, but he be bigging you up and all of that stuff. And why is he like that with Guru? And I was like, well, if that's his opinion, I got to respect that. I can't be mad. Like, oh, why don't you like Guru like you like me? You know, that because people don't like certain opinions I have. But I wasn't mad. I was just, but I was surprised.
Oh, yeah.
But I was like, you know what? If that's his opinion,
you gotta tip your hat and respect it.
And where that was, you know, like, that's back before, like, I was quote unquote famous, right? So for me, that's just
you were popping with, cause highly questionable for me. And I love that show. I told you, even the way you always have that look, like, I'm really tired of all you people. You just do the look. And it's so, yeah, and I know that's not an act. That's you.
No, that was me. But see, at that time, like, I'm just a dude talking about rap. Like, I'd be anywhere else as a dude talking about rap. And I didn't realize how many people were, like, listening to me talk about rap. And I find it interesting now when I go back and listen to old stuff that I didn't like as much as I did, as much, I didn't like as much then that I go back and check and I'm like, wow, I probably in a lot of ways had decided what I rock with and what I did not rock with. Yeah. And then when there was a deviation, I wasn't quite there. Like, it's so much fun for me now to go back and listen to stuff from the 90s and just be like I go back and listen to Moment of Truth. Mm-hmm. And Moment of Truth, which I think is a, like, largely masterpiece recording. And at the time, I was like mostly on the beats. And now I go back and listen to it. And now I guess also I'm an adult. So I have a much better understanding of what another adult on a record was talking about. And he's one I haven't revisited and been like, yeah, okay, I was tripping a little bit. It happens from time to time.
Yeah, no, but I respected your opinion. And it, even though, because people are like, man, it's almost like he got a personal problem with him. But I'm like, I respect people more that's direct instead of just dancing around it. You were just blatantly said, yo, this is how I feel. He never appealed to me that way, X, Y, Z. And again, it was some of my friends that were just like, yo, man, but I'm saying, I'm like, no. I come from Texas where the white people we were around, when they called you I'd rather that than the smile on your face and they feel the same way behind your back.
That is actually a very interesting thing about Texas that I have to explain to people, because when folks talk about, like, white folks being afraid of them, I'm like, I don't really know anything about that.
Exactly.
Right? These cats is packing. They don't fear us in the least, right? Yeah. And it was just like, okay, the ones you did not need to rock with, there was no mystery to this fact.
No doubt.
None.
100%.
None whatsoever. Yep. So you feel good about the new album?
Oh, yeah, man. Dropped November 1st, and it's just... It's just intro to outro the way, even just checking all the tweets and everybody responding to it. Everybody's just like, man, it sounds like a brand new album just made with y'all going in the studio together. It doesn't sound like I salvaged some old vocals. You know what I'm saying? If it sounded like that, I would never release it.
And you got the old gang back together. We got some M.O.P. Yeah. You got some Freddie Fox.
Yeah, Group Home, J-Rue the Damager, Q-Tip, who's hard to get on a record. You know, he jumped on it. Neo. Bless me. Nitty Scott, who's one of the dopest female MCs out there. She's incredible. Who else? Talib Kweli, you know, and all of us have toured together and been friends for so many years. So it was just an easy thing. You know, J. Cole, even him coming through, you know, I sent it to him. I texted it to him and said, hey, man, tell me if you feel this. And I swear it wasn't even maybe 5 minutes. He texted me and said, bro, where'd you get this? And you know what I'm saying? I'm like, this is old vocals that was never released. He's like, bro, I'm on this. He's like, how you got him sounding like this? And I'm like, I'm using this, I'm using that. Because he's into equipment and recording. Right. Obviously, most of J. Cole's hits he produced.
Right.
You know, so he was like, what plugins are you using? And I told him, because he's a person I know values it in a different way than people that don't take the whole I know he's a producer.
Right.
So shout to Cole, man.
What was the process like for you producing him? Because he, as a producer who produces himself.
Right. That was easy because he let me do my thing and he just said, look, the only thing he actually called me in regards to the song was maybe when he was halfway through writing it, he said, dude, cause the standard is 16 bars. And even when you hit up an artist, you know, I need a quick 16. He called me and said, hey man, I went over 16. Is that okay? I'm like, dude, you could do a million bars. Whenever you're done, I'll add the chorus and change the arrangement, but you're in charge of this. So you do your thing. And he went 24 bars. I was like, oof. And then I said, can I get a video? Cause you know, artists will be like, I can't do the video, especially at his caliber.
Right.
And then sometimes the labels won't allow it, but he was like, nah, I'm totally independent now. Yeah. I make the rules. I'm totally free from majors. I was like, cool. Let's get a video. And Fab Five Freddy did shot it, thanks to him. But he shot Just to Get a Rep as well back in 1990, so we were used to that. But, yeah.
Yeah, man, I know we're about time to wrap this up. Honestly, what are you into these days, musically?
Well, obviously the standard now go-tos is Kendrick, Drake, and Cole.
So you dig Drake?
Oh, yeah.
See, it's interesting, because I would think that Drake, like, might be a Drake. Little softer core than your preference.
I love Drake, man. But plus, I grew up into new wave music,
right.
And punk music. I was into all that. And I like my cool out stuff, you know, Phil Collins and, you know, just mellow stuff like that, Christopher Cross and, you know, things like that. But I have an 8-year-old son, and he likes The Baby, and he likes Gunna, and then he likes Roddy Ricch, and you know, A Boogie with a Hoodie.
Right.
You know, he's not into my music at all. And and his mother sometimes be like, you know, you got to put him on to your music. And I'm like, well, since he's 8,
when he becomes a teenager, his whole attitude is going to change.
Right.
You know, he's going to be like, he might even look at me as corny by that time. Right now he looks at me as cool because I am a cool guy.
Like, I used to remember when I talked to Combat Jack, rest in peace. One thing that was interesting is kind of like musically,
Reggie,
how having kids keeps you young in that way, right?
No,
like, that was the vibe that I always got off him because
he
was
Reggie's
always
good guy, man.
One of my favorite people in the world, man.
Yeah, I was with Reggie when Rockefeller were actually doing their contract to become Rockefeller. I was down at the lawyer's office because, you know, he practiced law and he was part of that deal.
The thing I always tell people about Reggie is he used to listen to my radio show when I was on Sirius, right? And he gave like the highest compliment I get at the time. He's like, I got Sirius for Howard Stern, but I flip over and go check you out for a little bit, right? And we just talked about all this stuff. And so when he got the podcast going, it was as my career was coming up and he'd always had me in. And one thing he said, he was just like, he told me that the fact that you were getting here and you still have, and you're getting here and you still staying true to this gives me some hope to where it's going. So I do his podcast once a year and he'd always be like, so how's the money looking these days? Right?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like his pocket watching. It was like, yo, things get a little better, huh? And I'm
there
like,
you go.
Yeah, things get a little better.
You know, like, it's like, man, God bless his soul, man. Great guy. We go way, way, way back to like the early 90s. So Reggie Ose, RIP, brother.
Yeah, but it's all good though that you're still into music as it comes out now.
Oh yeah, big time. I mean, I always say this, but hip hop, I don't think it's being such a cultured music, besides other genres of music, I don't think you can outgrow a culture. I don't think anybody, especially black and Latinos, being that it comes from that environment, I don't think we're gonna, you know, including yourself, I know you're not gonna be like, that rap was cool when I was young.
Right.
I don't mess with that no more. You know, I'm into my classical and my Zydeco music, you know what I'm saying? But you're gonna always, I know right now if Run DMC comes on, you hear Rockbox or I'm the King of Rock.
Yeah.
You're gonna be like, oh, this is my jam.
This is not music. People act like this is music to be outgrown.
No.
And I've never felt that. And like, I thought it's also been cool watching as, like, it's been around long enough for people to have like 20, 30 year careers.
Yeah.
And so you have people in their late 30s, early 40s, mid to late 40s.
Jay-Z's a great example.
That are speaking to what that experience is, right? Like, you go listen to a Bob Dylan record in 2019. It sounds like where Bob Dylan is in 2019.
Right.
And there's room for people to listen to Bob Dylan be Bob Dylan in 2019.
Yeah. I wanted a big, speaking of sports, this is ESPN. I wanted to shout out Chris Long.
Yeah, man.
I just did his podcast called The Fishbowl.
He's a good dude.
Great dude. And, you know, again, obviously his father, Howie Long, is such an icon. And he's from my era of football because, you know, even with the Oilers moving to Tennessee, at first we were already upset that they moved. But then when they changed the mascot to the Titans and just completely wiped the Oilers name, where for me, I didn't grow up on expansion teams at all. And especially for my childhood to be the Oilers, the Texans, it took me a minute to even want to even accept them. I have friends right now, even actually, shout to, Gerard Singleton. He, runs Singleton Funeral Homes. They're like the family funeral home that everybody goes to if you pass in Prairie View.
Yeah. I graduated with a Singleton.
Okay. And his father is a Omega Psi Phi frat with my dad and they came up together, but, he's the one that dressed my dad up and maybe prepared him for the funeral. And, I was like, oh man, why are you always bigging up Dallas Cowboys on your Instagram? He said, man, because when they left Houston, I was like, I'm not following no expansion team. And even though I'm from Houston, I'm not following them. I'm sticking with Dallas because they have not changed anything. I was like, okay, cause I just was never a Dallas fan, but that's crazy because a lot of people just said that we're going with Dallas because we don't want to support a team that didn't have the history of what the Oilers had. You know what I'm saying? So, I was the same way at first, but now, you know, I'm a Texans fan. So
indeed. It sounds like you're doing good though, man.
Oh yeah. Life is very good. And, you know, I just love what I do for a living and it's fun, man. It's still fun. Still fun.
I think the idea that it's still fun is like, you're kind of reassuring, but I also feel like you had a lane in your career where you didn't have to do a lot of stuff that you didn't want to do.
Yeah. And then on top of that, I have a radio show. I'm on Sirius XM. So, I'm on Eminem's channel, Shade 45. So they gave me a show that they said no rules, do it how you want to do it. They actually said, can you do it like you used to do on WBLS back in the 90s? And the guy Geronimo, who was the host, moved over to Sirius, and he became an executive. So he and my guy Reggie Hawkins, who was also an executive, who helped Star and Buck Wild become famous on radio, they were like, hey, we want you to do the same show you did on BLS over here, but now it's uncensored. You can curse, play whatever you want. And I was like, really? And because I used to do my own edits live. So Grandmaster Flash used to come in there and go, man, show me. I want to watch you do an edit live. And I would do it because I'd have a sheet of paper knowing when the curse is coming. Mm-hmm. And I'd do this little backwards thing. And they were like, wow, you're doing this on all these records, because a lot of songs didn't have radio versions back right then. And you know how much rappers curse. So next thing you know, they let me bring it over there. And it's called Live from Headquarters. It's in memory of our homie Headquarters who passed. And November 2nd is actually his 17-year anniversary of his passing. So
now, what channel on Sirius?
Eminem's channel.
Shade 45, right.
Every Tuesday from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time.
All right, check that out. And also check the new Gangstar album, One of the Best Yet, available right now. Yep. Check it out.
CD and vinyls coming, CD November 15th. And vinyl December 6th.
That is DJ Premier, my man. Yes. This is one of the most exciting things we've had happen on this podcast.
Thanks for having me, Bomani. Appreciate you, brother.
All right, man. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thanks to our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. Be sure to check out the Bill Barnwell Show. Bill is joined by Dan Graziano for the 3rd annual Coach's Hot Seat Draft. Check out the Bill Barnwell Show wherever you get your podcast. Also, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear. More driven.